Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since early June, Boston and much of the Northeast have been riveted by the ongoing trial of Whitey Bulger, the longtime alleged gangland leader and longtime fugitive. Bulger is facing a 33-count indictment, which includes 19 murders, as the reputed head of South Boston's Winter Hill Gang, which had tentacles that spread across the country, even touching Tulsa, the 1981 contract murder of Tulsa businessman Roger Wheeler. My guest today says while the trial has bared Bulger's reputation, far less has been said about the government's complicity in Bulger's alleged crimes, as Bulger was a longtime FBI informant and had corrupt officials from a variety of state and local agencies on his payroll. In fact, Bulger seemed to have powerful friends from the very beginnings of his career in crime. And that's the assessment of former longtime Boston Globe reporter Dick Lehr, and who co-authors with Gerald O'Neill for the book Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss, published by Crown. Lehr is currently a professor of journalism at Boston University, but has written about Bulger's life as a daily reporter for years and in two previous books. His latest book, he says, is an attempt to understand Bulger's actions and how he managed to influence protectors around him, from his FBI handlers to other more shadowy political influences. Lehr will be the guest of Booksmart Tulsa tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa County Bar Association at 15th and Boston for a free event. Dick Lehr joins us today to talk about Whitey Bulger here on Studio Tulsa. Dick Lehr, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is the second book you've written about Whitey Bulger with your co-author, and the third book in which he's been a sort of participant in the proceedings. What have you found so interesting about Bulger? What keeps you coming back to him?
Well, it's such a big story, first of all. We're not talking about, you know, a single case, a single incident. We're talking about 30, 40 years of the city's history, and then a story that goes far beyond in terms of impact Boston. And the other thing is that there's a lot of ways into the story. Early on, when I was a reporter at the Boston Globe back in the late 1980s, and we first started to scratch at the story of Whitey Bulger and his relationship with the Boston FBI, it was really the FBI piece that I think was interesting to us as journalists, because they're the nation's top law enforcement agency. And if the FBI is compromised or corrupted in connection with the gangster and crime boss, then that's a real public interest matter that is bigger in many ways than gangster X. So it really started where I think our focus and interest was at the public agency, so to speak. And then over time, the more we learned, Whitey Bulger in his own right, it's a horrifying, compelling story.
You know, Whitey's life arc sort of coincides with the birth and the science of criminology.
In a lot of ways, I guess, that's an interesting connection. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you write about it in the book. You know, the psychologists and psychiatrists start looking at, you know, what makes a psychopath. Criminologists looking at socioeconomic trends and what causes criminality. You know, he was a part of experiments during the 1950s and the early 60s when he was incarcerated.
With LSD.
Yeah, LSD. Yeah. So he sort of follows this timeline where we've learned what causes people to do this, and he is a walking casebook example of a lot of those areas of research.
Yeah, no, that's a good observation. And in fact, and I didn't know it going into writing and researching his biography, but you made reference to, you know, two prior books. I think one of the things that made researching his story, his biography, so fascinating is the fact that, you know, he's 84 now, 83, about to turn 84. He's lived a long time, and, you know, born in 1929, a few weeks before the stock market crashed. So it turns out, if once you start exploring his life, it becomes a study of the 20th century in America in many ways. And you piggyback him into so many fascinating areas, and you made mention of several of them.
Well, now, one of the things I was interested in is, you know, we knew that he had political influence once he was under the wing of the FBI and was able to commit a number of heinous acts, including one here in Tulsa, the murder of Roger Wheeler, which he ordered. But while as an informant for the FBI, but what was interesting to me was this political influence goes back to the very beginnings of his crime days, seemingly, because he always seemed to get off for a long time. And even when he was caught, he wasn't treated as harshly as others. And at that particular point, his brother, who would later become a state senator, a legislator, and president of the University of Massachusetts, he was a young man. He didn't have any political influence, but apparently the political influence was always there.
Yeah, early on, and again, deconstructing his juvenile criminal record from the late 30s and 1940s, he did have this amazing knack for, once he got arrested, of not paying any kind of real consequences for his juvenile crimes and whatnot. And that was all new material to really be able to come up with a scorecard, so to speak, for his early criminal history and realize, my gosh, there's the seed for the sense of entitlement that he developed later in life when the FBI was protecting him. The hard part was in those early days was it's as if there was some unseen hand, helping hand at work, but we couldn't pin it down. It's just that he had an amazing, unrealistic scorecard when it came to not paying any consequences.
And perhaps to me most interesting was the fact that at the time of his first major federal incarceration for bank robbery, John McCormick at that point was majority leader, but he's writing letters as the majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives on behalf of Whitey Bulger. Later, when he's the Speaker of the House, he's also writing to get him released from prison. To me, that is just utterly amazing.
Yeah, no, that's now you're going from the unseen hand to the now revealed hand, because that was a remarkable discovery that we came across when we got access to Whitey Bulger's vast federal prison file from the 9 years he did do time, starting in 1956, when he was a 26-year-old bank robber. We'd always known that the family had a relationship, a connection to their local congressman, then John McCormick, who was also from South Boston. But what we didn't realize, two things, was how involved the rising national political figure, John McCormick, had in affecting Whitey Bulger's time in federal prison, often at the behest of Whitey's younger brother, Bill, who you've already mentioned as being an up-and-coming politician locally in his own right. So you had, as you refer to, these amazing letters from arguably the third most powerful man in the country after the president and vice president, inquiring of prison superintendents and officials on the U.S. Bureau of Prisons about this young man from Boston, James J. Whitey Bulger, and how's he coming along? Is he ready for a transfer? That kind of thing. What inmate in America would not want to have those kinds of inquiries made on his behalf? It was astonishing.
Well, and give us a sense of the South Boston culture. Was it common for the lawful and the lawless to sort of, hey, what's up? That sort of, we're on different sides of the fence, but we're still neighbors and there's some bond. Is that the case for South Boston?
Oh, sure. It's actually a spit of land, a peninsula that sticks out into Boston Harbor and, connected to downtown by a bridge. So there's some geographic isolation historically. It's very Irish and very insular culturally that way. Southie pride is something of value in the neighborhood that goes way back, on a whole bunch of fronts. It's kind of a us versus them sort of neighborhood culture. And Whitey Bulger, fit right into that. And it's also a reflection of what, Boston is always known for, its obsession with politics, crime, and sports. And no better example of that is in South Boston itself.
Now, what's interesting, you detail his prison time where he spent, 9 years in federal prison?
Nine years, yeah.
Some in Atlanta and later at Alcatraz at one point, which he actually preferred to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Which was interesting, but...
Yeah, a little bit of outside-the-box kind of thinking. Yeah, you have to be kind of Whitey Bulger when you come to think of that Alcatraz is a better place than Atlanta, where he had come from.
And he kind of cracked up in Atlanta.
Yeah, no, he was 26. Got caught as a bank robber. And again, it's not local jobs. I mean, one of the jobs was out in Indiana. There was Rhode Island, and then there were a bunch in Massachusetts for which he pled guilty to one. But he'd already had this idea that, he can outfox and outsmart everyone and never get caught. And lo and behold, in one of his great life lessons, he was caught when one of his fellow bank robbers ratted and informed on him. And he couldn't believe it. And it became what we argue is one of the pivots and huge lessons he learned in life, is that despite the Irish culture and the underworld codes about never ratting on anybody, Whitey Bulger realized that it's better to be a rat than to be ratted on. Because in the same case, when he once he was apprehended and realized how he had been apprehended, he ended up cooperating and at the time secretly providing the authorities with the information to catch two other bank robbers.
Now, we think of the FBI informant days as like once he's in power and head of that South Boston gang he runs. But in fact, it goes back to much earlier.
Yeah, and that once again, that was one of the new revelations in working on his biography, that in 1956, after he was arrested, we came across documents which established that it was just about the bank robberies. It wasn't like an ongoing situation, but in an effort to improve his prison time and also that of his girlfriend, who might have gotten into trouble, he agreed to give up the names of two of his bank robbers, and they were quickly apprehended. Once again, it's like, oh, wow. I mean, if you knew the reputation and his public image for so many years until the truth came out, the idea that he would ever be a rat and informant just was a huge disconnect with his public persona.
In fact, the murder of Roger Wheeler here in Tulsa was actually on the instigation of the first FBI agent he worked with, Paul Rico, who had left and become head of security for World High Ally.
Yeah, you mentioned bring up Paul Rico, and he is probably at the top of the list of a band of Boston FBI agents who I'm not ever sure if they ever knew what the, you know, being a lawman was, because they were so lawless. And Paul Rico had been in Boston while Whitey was away in prison, and he cultivated an underworld informants, but he became basically a gangster himself, and his relationship with, in particular, a gangster by the name of Stevie Fleming, who became Whitey's partner. And after he retired, he got involved in World High Lie with a businessman and wannabe gangster, and then with the Bulger Gang and whatnot. And then Roger Wheeler bought the company, and unfortunately that was the beginning of the end for Roger Wheeler.
Yeah, basically he was suspecting that, and rightly so, that they were skimming. And in fact, Whitey was getting some proceeds, but it wasn't a lot of money as far as what was going to Whitey, was it? Or was it?
No, I mean, it's been established in the court testimony and whatnot is that, again, this businessman who was named John Callahan, who was an official in World High Life, had set up this scheme where, you know, Whitey and his gang would get about 10 grand a month or about $1 million a year. But the idea was it was for protection. So it was easy money. It wasn't a lot in terms of, again, the scheme of things for Whitey, but it was easy money because he didn't have to do anything for it. It was just Callahan wanted to be able to put off any other underworld La Cosa Nostra kind of overture saying, hey, guys, we already have a dance partner, you know, and that's the Bulger Gang. And it worked. But that was in play when Roger Wheeler took over the company. And it didn't take him long, apparently, to realize that, you know, the numbers weren't adding up. He brought in some outside accountants. And this posed a threat to the whole scheme that was underway. Their first attempt, you know, run by Callahan and Paul Rico, this retired FBI agent, was head of security at World High Life, was to try to put together a buyback bid, buy the company out, you know, from Wheeler. But no, he didn't want to sell. He just wanted to clean it up. And Plan B came to be Wheeler's execution.
Mm. And I assume you've been following the trial, and this has been a part of the trial, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think I've been in court, you know, once or twice a week. I was out of town last week, but Roger Wheeler's daughter, Pam, testified last week, you know, in connection with a lot of evidence and testimony that's been presented to the jury about the execution of Roger Wheeler.
And this is when Whitey is starting to maybe lose a little bit of his hold, because, you know, he killed a number of people or ordered a lot of people killed, but they were all in the crime business. And now he's, at this point, he's going outside of the crime business to what I guess people in the crime business would say bystanders.
Yeah, they call them civilians.
Civilians.
You know, they're not part of the game. They're not part of their world. Yeah, and that, again, is in some ways, you know, some would argue breaks their underworld code. Innocent women or civilians like Mr. Wheeler. And Whitey did begin adding those kinds of victims to his list, and it was all part of the price of an empire that was expanding beyond a neighborhood in South Boston but had reach around the country, whether it's to the Frontons in Miami and Connecticut or to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Mr. Wheeler lived. You know, the solutions to most of the problems that did arise for Whitey Bulger was murder.
My guest today is Dick Lehrer, professor of journalism at Boston University. He was a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe before that, and he's co-author with Gerald O'Neill of Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. And it's published by Crown, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When you think of FBI informants, you know, certainly 99% of us know what we see from, you know, film depictions, but what becomes apparent was that Whitey was not so much run by an FBI agent that was rogue, that he was basically running the FBI agent, a man named John Connolly for most of the time. When he's plotting murders, he's getting information about how to murder people through the FBI. The FBI protected him through all of that. Was he giving them such great information that it was worth it, or was it the fact that they were just so compromised they just refused to acknowledge what was happening?
Yeah, no, there are several factors. And no, he was not a terrific informant. He was an informant. And his partner, Stevie Flemmi, was an even better informant. The two of them worked with the agent you mentioned, John Connolly, together. Because Flemmi did have access to the mafia that, in a way that Whitey did not. But most of the key FBI federal investigations against the mafia could have been accomplished without the input, underworld input, from Whitey Bulger and Stevie Flemmi. That's what we've been able to determine by looking back at all the evidence. So what you have is this, you know, perversion of how the system is supposed to work. And the younger agent, the agent John Connolly, was originally from South Boston. He's about 10 or more years younger than Whitey Bulger. He grew up admiring Whitey Bulger and the Bulger family. He was a very ambitious agent who knew in the 70s all the action in terms of a career was around handling informants. John Connolly was close to Whitey's younger brother, Bill, the politician. And so you get this toxic brew of elements that came together in 1975 when Connolly recruited, it's like landing Moby Dick, you know, Whitey Bulger to become an informant. And Whitey saw the upside because almost instantly he turned John Connolly into his mole in the FBI, who provided him with all kinds of law enforcement intelligence about who was talking or who's trying to bug whom. And bottom line, that's probably the most distinguishing, historically, you know, distinguishing aspect about Whitey Bulger in terms of the annals of American crime, was that starting with Connolly and through Connolly, he was able to corrupt and control a handful of FBI agents. So they essentially were part of the gang and serving as his security force.
At his height, how much political influence he had? We mentioned the fact that John McCormick, Speaker of the House, is writing letters to get him out of federal detention and out of federal prison. But was it beyond the FBI? Was it local officials? Did he have? Do we know the extent?
Not the full extent, but you know, several gangsters have testified, and they always talk about the value and the importance for a gangster of having sources inside law enforcement. And the FBI and John Connolly weren't Whitey's only sources. I mean, he had an annual tradition at holiday time, and his line was, Christmas is for cops and kids. And he'd stuff envelopes, and he had a whole bunch of Boston cops that he paid off, as well as he had the special envelopes for a bunch of these FBI agents. But in that, what I just said is a great playbook move to have sources in law enforcement. The FBI is it. It's the top dog. And so the fact that Whitey was able to control a handful of FBI agents, I mean, that trumps everything else. They can find out things for you about what the state police is up to, about what the federal drug agents are up to. Much more power to their intelligence than, say, having a local beat cop on your pad.
One thing from reading the book is the way the FBI rewarded their agents was basically the ability to have an informant like a Whitey Bulger. Somebody who was letting them know what was going on or seeming to let them know what was going on. Has the FBI changed their practices, or are informants still as highly prized as ever?
Well, we should hope so. It's hard to know. Certainly after the Bulger scandal erupted in full bloom and all its horror in late 90s and ever since the late 90s, the Justice Department and the FBI overhauled their so-called informant guidelines and tried to beef up, at least on paper, you know, sort of the checks and balances. But it's a secret situation, so it's really hard to tell, because the old guidelines looked pretty good in terms of, you know, an agent having to be supervised and you know, be reviewed and have the informant be assessed, decide whether he's giving good enough stuff, all that stuff was on paper, but that was the genius and the success of Whitey was he not only corrupted what we'd call the line agent, his handler, but he got to the handler's supervisor. So you're knocking out the checks and balances once you start going up the ladder.
Interesting. Well, yeah. What finally unraveled all of this? Was there a particular incident that he was involved with, or was it a matter of other people in the FBI figuring out what was going on in Boston?
Well, it started with the press, the media. I was part of a team of reporters in 1988 in the Boston Globe that reported for the first time that Whitey Bulger and the FBI, namely John Connally, have a special/informant relationship going on. It was no one knew at the time, and that was mind-boggling for anyone to even fathom because of Whitey's reputation as the stand-up Irish gangster. No one knew at the time that about the corruption and the depth and the scope of it. It was like it was the first cut, the tip of the iceberg, and it took years. I mean, that was 1988, and it was 10 years later, during 10 months of federal court hearings here in Boston, where the FBI for the first time was forced to confirm that Whitey had been an FBI informant, that there had been a lot of corruption. And I think what you had was, this combination of things. You had the media playing its role in a free society, and then you had history turning a page in the early 90s. Again, this had been going on for so long. Connally was retired. Some of the other agents had moved on. You had a new generation of federal prosecutors who were trying to build a case, and they did, against Whitey Bulger, and that led to, bumping up against this what had been, until then, kind of a sealed container of all this horror.
He finally did go on the run in 95, but, here he was literally on the run for well over a decade. Hard to believe. I mean, it was 2011, and really President Obama played a little role in that because the woman who was got her suspicion going was he was off on a racist rant about President Obama, and that made her think about the guy in a different way.
Yeah.
But the guy managed to avoid detection. He lived all over the place. He lived down in the Delta. Mississippi Delta, and then of course in Santa Monica for a number of years.
Once again in 95 when the indictments had been filed secretly, his FBI, even though he was in retirement, John Connally continued to monitor things on behalf of Whitey and gave him the heads up that they're coming to get you. And Whitey hit the road, and he became he was gone for 16 years. 14 of them were spent in Santa Monica, where he kind of reinvented himself. We call it the mask of Charlie Gasco, which was his alias, and his companion, Catherine Gregg, became Carol Gasco. And they lived a life, not far from the ocean, a couple blocks away, of just a retired couple. They said they were from Chicago, and he'd been in a businessman in insurance and whatnot.
I mean, this is the thing about it, is he just managed to change his persona, I assume pretty completely.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really enjoy doing in the biography is you're getting trying to as best we could is to get into his psychology a little bit and his motivations and what made him tick and how as you're just saying, how could a guy who was a killer who seemed to by all accounts enjoy killing, who was a crime boss and was the most powerful underworld figure in Boston, how do you flick a switch and become this Charlie Gasco? This low-key, quiet guy who lives in apartment 303, in this building, and we explore that a little bit, and I think a lot of it has to do with, and it kind of adds up, is that for him it was about power and being in charge, and the circumstances might change, but he was sustained and nourished by the sense of beating everybody and being one step ahead. And so during the FBI years in Boston, that meant having an agent tipping you off, and you're outfoxing everybody. And I think when he's Charlie Gasco in California, it's catch me if you can, and you can't, finding a way. And so it was power more than it was money and other kinds of things that, that made him move and turned him on, because even when he was at the top of his game in Boston, it wasn't material things. He didn't live in a mansion the way the mafia underboss did, and he didn't live in a high lifestyle. That wasn't important to him. Being the man, the boss, in power, in control, those are the things that always have made him tick.
But of course, when he's on the road, he that power structure is totally gone. Now it's just basically outsmarting those who are after him.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, and I think that was a, and that sustained him, that nourished his ego and whatever his needs were. And so that's what I think it was. It was more about that than it was about, you know, being the boss of the underworld. It was just, you know, it was all about him.
What are your thoughts on the trial? This trial's been going on through the spring and summer. Are we learning new things or confirming what you suspected or perhaps already knew?
For me and the band and the handful of journalists in Boston who have really been studying and following this for many years, there's a fresh detail here and there. But there's been a little bit of a disappointment in terms of our hopes or the public's hope that we'd learn more about, you know, the corruption inside the FBI and whether how far up the ladder it did go from the ground in Boston and perhaps into Washington. There was, and maybe that was naive, a hope that Whitey's lawyers would aggressively be able to, you know, spit some more of that stuff out. That hasn't happened. So I think the public is, and that's the kind of accountability I think the public deserves. But otherwise, it's been a pretty strange and surreal trial because most of the criminal charges, Whitey seems barely to be concerned about and fighting. His attorneys in the opening argument referred to him as a crime boss, an enormously successful one who made millions upon millions. So he's almost, he conceded, you know, 90% of the charges. But the thing is that he's obsessed with, through his lawyers, his lawyers are like channeling him, is trying to like rehabilitate his sort of good bad guy image from way back, and he's insisting he was never an informant, and that's pretty much a laugh line at this point. And to hear his lawyers at times almost embarrassing themselves with trying to pursue that argument because it's in the mountain of evidence that exists to the contrary, it's as if they're standing up and arguing that the world is flat after all these years. And so that's given it a really kind of peculiar and unique and therefore fascinating twist.
One of the things you write several times in the book, you mentioned the Wheeler family and their denial of justice for so long. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a number of other people, the families of some of his victims, just people in the wrong place at the wrong time. Do you think they're going to get closure from this?
I don't know. I mean, they're asked that, and there's anywhere from, you know, 6 to 12, you know, survivors, victims, you know, families, sons who have grown up who attend the trial every day, and they talk about how they need to see this, you know, Bulger be brought to justice. And that's going to happen. But whether that does bring closure, I can't imagine being in their shoes or the Wheeler family's shoes. I don't think so. I think there's so much of it is just the anger and the betrayal by the cops, the guys who were supposed to be good, and to realize, you know, what a hand they played in Mr. Wheeler's murder, for example, and the murders surrounding World Highlight. You know, it's hard to ever recover, I think, when you realize the scope of the government betrayal. You expect bad guys to be bad, but boy, you certainly don't expect the FBI to agents to be criminals like this.
That aid and abet too. Yeah, right.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the name of the book is Whitey: The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. Dick Lehrer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dick Lehrer is a professor of journalism at Boston University, a former reporter for the Boston Globe, and co-author with Gerald O'Neill of Whitey: The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. He'll be signing and talking about the book tonight at a BookSmart Tulsa event that takes place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Tulsa County Bar Association. That's located at 15th and Boston. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.